Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We have a lot to share. 6 surprising health benefits from garlic. Air pollution linked to irregular heartbeats and lung blood clots. Poor health, lifestyle factors linked to memory complaints in young people. That's a big one. Also, we're going to look at things such as beets are so healthy that even pharmaceutical giants want to harness their antioxidant potential. How bananas are better than pills for treating depression and constipation. How E. coli is detected in Portland water up in Oregon. How 54 million Americans are affected by osteoporosis. It should be zero. And that's just some of what we're going to talk about in the health segment of our program today. Always from peer review, independent science, and then from our environmental segment, 76% of the seed market is patented by corporations. From Elizabeth Rentner, Natural Society, start saving seeds. And by the way, I believe that that would be a great opportunity for people to do in their own home-based business, saving seeds. Also from our environmental segment, a mysterious disease on the Pacific coast of Alaska. Livers are crumbling, hearts enlarging, a pale yellow lymph nodes, blood-filled lungs, and a professor worrying there's no answers. Big public health concern. Testing carcasses now for Fukushima radioactivity. Also, from our comments, why trust an organization that lies constantly, cheats at everything? Oh, we're talking about the CDC. Some specifics on that. My guest in the second part of our program will be Chris Sod from San Diego. He is a peace activist, and he has done a lot to help bring humanitarian relief during the Lebanese War. He was the founder of the Olive Branch Center in Charlotte, North Carolina. He also teaches with Andrew Harvey at the International Academy of Sacred Leadership. Our comment today, the demise of earlier religious and spiritual beliefs, and the rise of a new wave of spirituality based upon social justice and caring for people and the earth. That'll be an interesting conversation. Then also 5 reasons to boycott Starbucks. In our social issue segment, we're taking on Starbucks. Also from Robert Perry, Consortium News, the only standards in America are double standards. So we'll talk about that. Also, a study suggests that 1 in 8 American children are maltreated before they're 18. From Child Protective Services, a new article in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Pediatrics says that we have just millions of abused children. They're maltreated. Well, there's a cumulative prevalence, and we're not talking about it. So we'll talk about it on this program. Also, I don't know what else we can get to today because I have so much to deal with, but I'll get to as much as I can, including devastating human impact on the Amazon rainforest revealed. And hopefully we'll have some time. Can narcissists be moved to show empathy? So you see, we have a lot to explore. Let's begin. I was being taken to a lecture in Los Angeles by a professor at the university. And his daughter had just returned from Beijing and asked, could she come to the lecture? I said, sure. So that we were all in the car driving, his family. And she said, would you believe that just 2 days ago, I'm walking down the street to the campus where I'm going, I held up my hand in front of me and I could not see it. You had to walk very slowly because it was absolute, complete darkness. This was at 11 o'clock in the morning. That's how polluted it is. Everyone has to wear special masks and filters, and it only gets better when they ban cars. So for the Olympics, people got to see the sky and breathe the air in a way that they wouldn't otherwise if they were living there. She said, sometimes when you're up on the 20th floor, 25th floor of a building, and you look out, you can't see anything. Now, it's not just the aestheticism, it's also the health consequences. According to the British Medical Journal, quote, air pollution is linked to irregular heartbeat, lung blood clots, and that's according to a large study. But picture less clear is the issue when it comes to heart attacks and stroke risk, but its impact on directly boosting the risk of heart attacks and stroke is clear. So here's the issue. The more polluted the air that you're living in, working in, then you could be contributing to a heart attack. So 400,000 heart attacks recorded by one group, more than 2 million emergency admissions for cardiovascular problems, 600,000 deaths just this past year from heart attack and stroke. And that was just with average levels of air pollution. Over a five-day period, they were measuring this to see what does it do to you. Air pollutants, including carbon monoxide, nitrogen dioxide, particulate matter, especially particulate matter 10 and 2.5, sulfur dioxide, ozone, all this is in the ambient daily air, and this gets into our lungs. And we think, if I can't see it, then it must not be there. Wrong. Some particulate matter is very small, but just as immunocompromising and inflammatory. So that's one of the reasons that we should be filtering our air in our offices and homes, having a lot of plants, especially the ivies, that helps absorb the toxins out of the air. Poor health. Lifestyle factors linked to memory complaints among young adults. From the University of California, Los Angeles, here's what they have to say. They looked at 18,000 people about their memory and then tied that into their lifestyle. And also they looked at who was depressed and high blood pressure, and they're finding all these are interrelated. This was published in the current issue of PLOS ONE, and it can better help scientists realize that your lifestyle choices do make a difference. Now, I've said that for a long time, that every choice you make in life will have an outcome, every single one. So if we don't pay attention because we haven't been told that the French fries, hot dogs, hamburgers, pizzas, colas, and coffee we're drinking are a problem, there's almost zero probability we're going to change. We'll just keep going more the same. But there is a problem. And that is everything that we do that contributes to poor health also immediately impacts memory. Because it's not just your lungs or your heart that's taking a beating, it's your brain. And when we see how much exposure people have to that which can cause inflammation or destruction of brain cells, a person when I was growing up might have, let's say at the age of 20, had a brain damage of someone maybe 25. But today, someone 20 who's been binge drinking, drugging, a lot of smoking, eating garbage, their brain could easily be 40. And hence, younger people are finding memory complaints. Quote, overall, 20% of those polled had memory complaints, including 14% of younger adults. So just keep in mind that what we're seeing today is the phenomena of speeding up the aging processes and the diseases associated with it. And that's not good. But something is good is garlic. Now, garlic has been used around the world for a long time, thousands of years. And there's a rationale for using it, aside from its taste. There's over 100 very important phytonutrients in garlic. And garlic is clear in its research that it can do the following. It can help reduce the risk of lung cancer. There's a major Chinese study that analyzed data for thousands of participants. Those who ate raw garlic twice a week had half the lung cancer risk as those who did not. It can lower your blood sugar. That's a big, big benefit if you have diabetes or prediabetes. And in fact, in a clinical trial, diabetic patients who receive metformin, a diabetic drug, and garlic extract had better glycemic control than those receiving just the drug alone. But the garlic was also able to lower triglycerides and total cholesterol. Garlic is great for food poisoning. Now, I believe that if you ever have food poisoning, the first thing you do is you take about 15 charcoal capsules to absorb the toxin. But right behind that, I'd be putting a lot of manuka honey, like a tablespoon, with raw garlic juice and get that down your system. Why? Because garlic can be 100 times more powerful than conventional antibiotics in combating Campylobacter jejuni, the bacteria that is often the culprit in food poisoning. Garlic can help prevent arthritis. Why? Because it's rich in alum. That is onions, garlics, leeks, shallots, wild onions. And very important because the vegetables called the disulfides inhibit the breakdown of cartilage in bones or in the joints. And you can eat garlic crushed, raw, juiced, or just very lightly sauteed. And sprouted garlic is even better. Don't throw away those green shoots that come out of garlic. That's rich, rich, rich in antioxidants. And so that's what I would suggest. One of the reasons we should be having garlic. Also, there's an area called psychobiotics. Maybe you haven't heard of it. Psycho, P-S-Y-C-H-O, biotics, B-I-O-T-I-C-K-T-I-C-S. That can feed your gut-brain health axis. And that's important. So now we realize that the good bacteria in our gut will impact brain function, and hence the psychobiotics. Quote, this is from a professor, John Cryon. It's really an exciting frontier in medicine right now to try and understand the potential of how the gut microbiome can play a role in brain development and behavior. Therefore, we might be able to develop novel strategies targeting the gut microorganisms, what we call psychobiotics, that may be useful in the treatment of certain mental disorders. Okay, let's put this together. We know that probiotic strains like lactobacillus have the potential to affect the gut-brain axis. And that we also know that stress and distress, disorders like anxiety, depression, and irritable bowel syndrome are almost always in children with autism spectrum disorder. And so what we should do is we should be giving all children with any form of developmental disorder or vaccine-related disorder, including autism, a full detoxification with lots of probiotics 2 to 3 times a day and keeping the gut clean, and then give them methylated B12, methylated folic acid, vitamin C. That will make an enormous difference in helping them. And now we know the healthier bacteria in your gut, the healthier your brain. And magnesium supplements improve metabolic syndrome. And that is important. Quote, metabolically obese, normal weight individuals in this study were found that when they got magnesium, made all the difference in the world. So if you have metabolic syndrome, which can contribute to diabetes and heart disease and hypoglycemia, make sure you're getting, I would say, 800 to 1,000 milligrams a day of magnesium. That can help you. And so that is the latest on health and healing, except for bananas. New study shows that how bananas are better than pills for treating depression from Natural News. Quote, they're often the fruit of choice for athletes looking to boost their electrolyte levels and get a quick energy boost. But bananas are a whole lot more than just a sweet treat or a pleasant addition to a morning smoothie. They're rich in vitamins and minerals and other beneficial compounds. Bananas can also serve as a natural remedy for treating depression, promoting regularity, boosting brain power, and calming the nerves. A closer look at the scientific literature on bananas reveals a host of little-known benefits associated with eating the fruit. Everything from regulating blood pressure and healing a damaged gut to relieving the symptoms of arthritis and even battling drug addiction have been attributed to this simple fruit. Now, what impressed me was that how much tryptophan you can find in bananas, the same compound that creates calm, relaxed moods. Bananas are also said to aid in relieving the symptoms of depression. So if you have a 100 milligrams B-complex or 50 milligrams B-complex, the conversion of tryptophan into serotonin, the so-called happy hormone, helps improve mood and overall feelings of well-being. And the fiber in bananas help keep you regular. And it also has lots of good electrolyte minerals, which are good for your heart, your kidneys, and other body organs. In fact, quote, a 2013 study published in the Journal of Neuroscience Letters researched potassium supplements and the level of free radicals in the brain. After 20 days of supplementing with potassium, the levels of harmful free radicals decreased significantly, reducing the amount of oxidative damage that occurs. So, one more reason to have your bananas. That's the latest on health and nutrition. Now, some of the other things I want to take on here today. First up for you to consider so you can call in and share your points of view. From Natural Society, quote, very few know what has been hidden from public view regarding the CDC's lies, cover-ups, and congressional investigation. Probably those who don't know don't want to. Well, here are some examples of CDC corruption for those who do want to know. One, remember the 2008 swine flu scare? A CBS News program called Washington Unplugged wanted to know more details about how those figures were derived, but the CDC stonewalled its producer-writer, Cheryl Atkinson. She went around the CDC by surveying each individual state's health agency and discovered that very few swine flu cases reported by the CDC were confirmed as swine flu. Most were actually a normal seasonal flu. Upon further pressure from Cheryl at Washington Unplugged, the CDC clamped down more and decided they couldn't track swine flu cases anymore because, quote, it was too difficult. The CDC quit doing what they're supposed to because they got caught cooking the swine flu statistics to promote a dangerous swine flu vaccine. It was a massive fraud. This was a rare case of kudos for the one reporter, Cheryl. And by the way, that's what reporting should be. If you remember at the time, I published along with Richard Gale three articles showing we did not have a swine flu epidemic, that the swine flu was fraudulent, there was no evidence it would prevent the swine flu, and it had lots of mercury in it. So check out some of those articles. Number two, the CDC lies about mercury in vaccines, and that they've done for a long time. As early as 1998, the CDC knew that there were problems using thimerosal, mercury in vaccines. Their own researchers turned in an internal memo stating this. The CDC decided to cover this up by hiring fake studies to explain away those mercury links to the rising autism. The earliest disinformation fraudulent study was the Danish study, masterminded for the CDC by Kristen Madsen, whose partner, Paul Thornton, had recently been indicted for fraudulent funding activities. This bogus study became the cornerstone for the foundation of lies, quote, proving thimerosal was not a factor for causing autism. Oh, yes, it is a factor in causing autism and other childhood developmental disorders and disabilities because we have the names and the judgments rendered to parents and their children into the tens of millions of dollars in the vaccine court. So on the one hand, the mainstream media says there's no link between vaccines and autism, and at the very time they're saying that to a vulnerable and gullible public, the other side of the government agency is saying, yes, we deem that your child suffered irreparable brain damage, including autism spectrum disorder, mitochondrial disorders, represented as autism spectrum disorder, and here's a lifetime compensation. Not just one, or two, or 10, or 20. Dozens. So the media should have brought this story of this fraud and cover-up immediately to the public's attention, and chose not. And finally, in 2007, Senator Tom Coburn issued a report titled CDC Off-Center. The report cites huge mismanagement of funds for non-disease-related expenses, generous payrolls, overly lavish facilities and trips. The full title of the CDC is Center for Disease Control and Prevention, but they could not explain how they were preventing disease to the senator. A PhD biochemist, Brian Hooker, whose son became autistic after a series of vaccinations, filed a suit against the CDC for violating the Freedom of Information Act by not releasing data he has been requesting since 2005 regarding CDC's internal memos on mercury and vaccines. Hooker finally got the memos after several years and 100 Freedom of Information Act requests, which prove the CDC was well aware of thimerosal mercury dangers in vaccines, even while they were assuring the public those dangers did not exist at all. Vaccination shills such as Forbes magazine and others did their best at CDC and vaccine industry damage control by attacking Brian Hooker and what he found. Unfortunately, it doesn't take much to help the CDC cover their cover-ups. Most of the public is enamored with the Hollywood image of the CDC, which is partially managed with some of their $10 billion plus dollar budget. Just one giant cesspool. It should be closed down completely. From our environmental segment, we have two reports. The first is from ENE News. Quote, mysterious illness that's been plaguing seals. The Bering Strait in the North Slope, starting in the summer 2011, up to 300 seals were found suffering from hair loss, skin sores, and unusually lethargic behavior. Dozens of walruses were also found with similar sores, causing marine mammal regulators to declare an unusual mortality event. Walruses have been taken off the list. Seals are still on it, displaying hair loss. University of Alaska Fairbanks have begun testing infected seal carcasses for Fukushima radiations. The results will be released in about a month, and I'll give them to you. And what they found was that these open sores, they found ring seals, ribbon seals, bearded seals, spotted seals, all of them had diseases. Quote, an investigation of the mysterious disease that caused skin lesions and hair loss among Alaskan Russian walruses has been closed without identifying the root cause. Well, they didn't test for radiation. Now they are. What do you want to bet? They find it. 76% of seed market is patented by corporations. Hence, save the seeds. From Elizabeth Rentner, Natural Society, quote, over 90% of the crop varieties grown a century ago are no longer used in this country. Many aren't even maintained in seed storage facilities. In addition to that, just 6 companies in the world have patented most of the seeds grown in the entire global agriculture market. Our food diversity is crumbling, and it's largely because corporations, not people, are in charge of the supply. But saving seeds in your vegetable garden or on your small family farm could potentially sustain the current diversity and slow or even reverse the degradation of our food supply. So get yourself some seeds, plant, and then let's say tomatoes. Get as many different types of tomatoes as possible. Those that you're going to use in making sauces or using in salads, good. Dry the rest, and then save all those seeds. Do the same thing with cucumbers and other variety of fruits and vegetables. We need to have people saving seeds, because whoever controls the seed controls the source of food. I think it's prime time we realize that. From our environmental segment also, from Lancaster University. Devastating human impact on the Amazon rainforest reveal, quote, "The human impact on the Amazon rainforest has been grossly underestimated," according to an international team of researchers from Brazil and UK, led by Lancaster University. They found that selective logging and surface wildfires can result in an annual loss of 54 billion tons of carbon from the Brazilian Amazon, increasing greenhouse gas emissions. This is equivalent to 40% of the yearly carbon loss for deforestation when entire forests are chopped down. This is the largest ever study estimating above and below ground carbon loss from selective logging and ground level forest fires in the tropics. Data based upon 70,000 sampled trees and thousands of soil litter and deadwood samples from 225 sites in eastern Brazilian Amazon. The forest degradation often starts with logging of prized trees such as mahogany and ipy. Felling and removing of these large trees, often dozens at a time in one given area, damages the whole area. Once the forest has been logged, the many gaps in the canopy means it becomes much drier due to exposure to the wind and sun, and that increases wildfires spreading inside the forest. The combination of selective logging and wildfires damages the forest even more and doesn't allow smaller trees to grow. So far, climate change policies in the tropics have effectively been focusing on reducing carbon emissions from deforestation only, not accounting for emissions from coming from forest degradation. Now, here are my thoughts on this, and hopefully later in about a week August, my intent is to fly the entire Amazon from one end to the other, filming it, and then interviewing people along the way, and then go from there over to Antarctica, then other places, Australia, and places that are becoming pure deserts will not be sustainable in the future. In any case, you have very corrupt people within the governments of all the countries of South America. And you have very powerful interests, the oligarchs within every country. The average person has no say-so in any of this. They're the victims of it. So when we talk about economic development and how much a country has grown, 4%, 8%, how much that was based upon cutting down their hardwood forest and shipping it off to Japan or China, how much of that was based upon leveling off enormous amounts of rainforest so they could grow soybeans genetically engineered to feed to cattle and pigs and chickens in Europe or in the Far East that want more of what we eat? We never talk about this, and no one's doing a single thing to stop it. So that's the reality of it. And finally, the only standards are double standards, from Robert Perry. Sometimes in dealing with U.S. government and its compliant mainstream media, I'm left with a feeling that if it weren't for double standards, there'd be no standards at all. From President Barack Obama to the editors of the Washington Post to the New York Times, it's obvious that what's good for the goose is good for the gander. An election in an embattled country is valid, even inspiring, if it turns out the way the official Washington wants, as in Ukraine last month. Otherwise, it's a sham and illegitimate, so they say, as in Syria this month. Similarly, people have an inalienable right for self-determination if it's Kosovo or South Sudan, but not if it's Crimea or the Donbass region of Ukraine. Those referendum of separation from Ukraine must have been rigged, though there is no evidence they were. Everything is seen through the eye of the beholder, and the beholders in official Washington are deeply biased. When it comes to military interventions, U.S. officials, such as our ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, assert a responsibility to protect, transcending national sovereignty, if civilians are threatened in Libya or in Syria, but not when the civilians are being slaughtered in Gaza, Odessa, or Donetsk. When those killings are being done by U.S. allies, the allies are praised for their restraint. The hypocrisy extends to the application of international law. If some leaders in Africa engage in actions that cause civilian deaths, they must be indicted by the International Criminal Court and dragged before The Hague for prosecution by jurists representing an outraged world. But it's unthinkable that there would be any accountability for George Bush, Dick Cheney, Tony Blair, and other so-called respectable leaders who invaded Iraq and caused the death of hundreds of thousands in the last decade. The United States also presents itself as the great guardian of democracy and constitutional order, except when those democratic impulses conflict with U.S. interest. Then the American people are treated to the cognitive dissonance of overthrowing democratically elected governments in the name of democracy. Ukraine is a case in point. When Ukraine President Yanukovych rejected austerity demands from the International Monetary Fund that accompanied a plan for European association, senior U.S. officials simply said, "Time's up, gotta go, let's get the protests going," and hence the United States spearheaded a neo-Nazi militia that violated and violently overthrew the democratically elected Yanukovych, even though he was corrupt. The State Department's public diplomacy officials then spun a narrative that glued white hats on the coup leaders and black hats on those who sought to defend the elected government. Whenever people mention the inconvenient truth that the crucial neo-Nazi role in providing the muscle for the coup, they were accused of spreading Russia propaganda. Yet while U.S. meddling in the internal affairs of another country is a good thing, it's a bad thing if a U.S. adversary does the same thing or is just suspected of doing it. When American and French volunteers go to Syria to fight with the U.S.-backed rebels, terrorists, those volunteers are, of course, operating on their own, such as American suicide bombers. To suggest otherwise without proof would be a conspiracy theory, a point with which I agree. But remember, the rules are flexible. While the U.S. press corps would mock anyone who jumped to a conclusion that the American and French jihadists in Syria must have connections to Washington and Paris, the opposite assumption applies to any disfavored government. Then the U.S. press simply just knows. We're certain that some indigenous resistance must be directed from some nefarious foreign capital. For example, the U.S. government is accusing Russia of somehow being behind the unrest in eastern Ukraine. And yet, Yanukovych's political base, even though the unparalleled U.S. intelligence agencies and American journalists on the ground have been unable to detect any proof of this alleged direction from Moscow. Still, the assumption led the New York Times to get suckered into a State Department propaganda ploy when the Times ran a lead story based on photographs supposedly showing covert Russian military teams that were clearly, end quote, in Russia, but then popped up in eastern Ukraine. 2 days later, however, the Times was forced to retract its scoop when it turned out that the key photo purportedly taken in Russia had actually been snapped in Ukraine, destroying the story's premise. But that egg-on-the-face moment only made the Times more determined to prove that the ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine indeed were minions of Moscow. Not free-thinking people simply reject what they regard as the imposition of illegitimate authority from Kiev. So when some Russian nationalists crossed the border to help their ethnic brethren in eastern Ukraine, it was assumed, again without any evidence, that Russia's president must have sent them. Times reporter Sabrina Tavernis traveled to a major city but could not find the desired evidence. The Russian nationalists said they had no connections to Moscow and were motivated simply by a determination to help protect fellow ethnic Russians from the escalated military assault from western Ukraine. Despite this disappointing finding, the Times front-page story on June 1st still made the desired point through the headlines, quote, "In Ukraine war, Kremlin leaves no fingerprints." Is that kind of like you saying, New York Times, "Weapons of mass destruction, we haven't found them, but we're sure they're there"? No. The phrasing assumes that Russian interference is real, just as the culprit has been careful to wipe up all the evidence. The article stated its conclusions this way, quote, "Mr. Putin may not be directing these events, but he is certainly their principal beneficiary. But that this is tendentious phrasing even. Putin has shown a willingness to have a dialogue with Ukraine's new president in hopes of calming down the crisis on Russia's borders. But official Washington's narrative of the crisis must always be maintained, whatever the lack of verifiable evidence, though an objective observer might note that the crisis was provoked last year by a reckless European Union association offer, followed by the International Monetary Fund draconian austerity plan that was rejected by the president of the Ukraine, prompting U.S. to encourage violent demonstrations, and it is fundamental to the U.S. propaganda theme to boil the storyline down to Russian aggression. Obama should have known better that Putin's response was reactive to the West's provocations, not a case of Russian provocation. And there we have it. As I said, if it weren't for double standards, there'd be no standards at all. And that's from Robert Perry. I'm Gary Null. We're going to take a break. Come back and go to our guest. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Null. We'll go to our guest in San Diego in a few moments, who he is standing by. And we will look at the demise of earlier religious and spiritual beliefs and the rise of a new wave of spirituality based upon social justice and caring for people of the earth. Just one quick little fun drive here, and this is to help with the station. All the income goes to the station. This is quite simply one of the best. They created this in the office in New York. Here it is. And I'm going to give you the number to call in and an 877 number in a second. You're going to get a 3-month supply of one of the most single important nutrients there is, coenzyme Q10. 60 soft gels, 120 milligrams. That's 3 bottles. Of coenzyme Q10. I take a little container with me of my nutrients. I mix all the powders together and put it in a bag. And I always have to take the labels in case anybody asks when I'm traveling, you know, an inspection, what is this? And I show them. Never had a problem. But I always make sure I have my coenzyme Q10 because I know what it does, how important it is. So I'm giving you 3 bottles. Also, I'm giving you 3 bottles of the green stuff capsules, and a free copy of Shopping and Cooking DVD documentary. This would normally cost $360. You're getting a 3-month copy of supply of green stuff, 3-month supply of coenzyme Q10 plus book. You're saving $200. That's an enormous saving. For example, in the green stuff, it's a valuable source of chlorophyll, magnesium, potassium, superoxide dismutase, alanine, arginine, aspartic acid, cysteine, glycine, histidine, isoleucine. It has wheatgrass juice, barley green juice, alfalfa leaf juice, oatgrass juice, broccoli, parsley, cabbage, kale, pineapple flavor, spirulina, yucca. It's got all that in it. It is a phenomenal product. and also the ORAC. You also have the documentary you're getting. So you're getting a 3 month supply of green stuff capsules. 3 months. 3 months supply of coenzyme Q10, high potency. And you're saving $200, plus you're getting this wonderful documentary I did showing you how to shop and cook from A to Z. You'll enjoy it. Here's the number. Your cost is only at $169.95. That's it. You're saving over $200. $200 savings. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. This special is for the next 24 hours. 877-627-5065. Huge savings, $200 savings, 3 months, then you're loading up. Let's say hello to my guest standing by from San Diego, Lebanese Christian peace activist who was a leader in the nonprofit nonviolent peace work and humanitarian relief during the Lebanese War and founder of Olive Branch Center in Charlotte, North Carolina, and also co-teach with Andrew Harvey at the International Academy of Sacred Leadership, which focus on heart-centered life coaching and socially engaged activism. And earlier, Chris directed the Institute for Life Leadership and Coaching for 16 years. He has a higher degrees in human development and was trained as a Jungian and existential psychologist. His recent work is Second Wave Spirituality, Passion for Peace, Passion for Justice, which chronicles and comments on global demise of earlier religious and spiritual belief systems in the emergence of new spirituality. Nice to have you with us today, Chris.
Hello.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, do you pronounce your last name Saad?
Well, you have to kind of double on the A, Saad, but that's close enough.
Saad, okay, S-A-A-D-E, all right.
Right, right.
Well, often when I confront followers of modern spiritual paths, whether they're East or West, and usually among the older generation of boomers, my generation, with the critical challenges and threats facing our society and the planet, it's not uncommon to hear them say, I can't be bothered with these problems of the world, or I don't want to know about it.
Yeah.
And yet I'm always told how people come from love and that their heart is always breaking and aching and that they feel connected. And then I say, okay, that's good that you're connected. To what? What are you actually
right.
doing? And then
right.
they say, well, I don't have time for that. I don't want to get involved in that. So you're
right.
connected to other people suffering, but you're not going to end it. You're connected to destruction of the environment. You're not going to protest against it. I see who comes to the demonstrations. I've been in three demonstrations on three different issues in the last 4 weeks. I see people who are there, and I see a lot of people who made it reasons not to be. So many of these people are longtime spiritual practitioners for decades and even leaders in their spiritual communities. What this tells me is that there is a serious, absolutely condescending hypocrisy, blatant hypocrisy, in the many religions and spiritual teachings promulgated today. For example, where were the congregations of the churches and the mosques and the synagogues and the temples during the Occupy demonstrations? I was down in Zuccotti Park every day from the first day. And although I'm sure there were many people who embraced the spiritual path present there, there was no sign of this religious and spiritual groups as a collective presence. So I'd like to begin by hearing your analysis of the present failures and even the irrelevance of older religious belief patterns that disengage people from being more socially and politically active in challenging the enemies of a sustainable world and planet that aspires to peaceful coexistence between all peoples, nations, races, genders, and faiths. And then, what characterizes and differentiates second-wave spirituality, as you have called it, from the older spiritual ethics that have dominated religious beliefs for centuries? The form is yours.
Well, Gary, you are so right in saying that there is a serious problem. And I fully agree with you. It is tremendously serious. For too long, faith and spirituality, not only faith, but those who espouse more spiritual journey, have bought into a personalized person-centered and person-limited understanding of spirituality. So it becomes a question of their relationship to the divine, as they define it, and their well-being. And that was, in some ways, that was the beginning, and we needed to start there. But we got stuck there. And they separated the idea of faith and spirituality from social engagements, from social justice, from the suffering of children, from the suffering of the poor, and today, from the ecological crisis. And unfortunately, that really played well with the powers that be that would want nothing less than spiritual people who are totally disconnected from the earth and the problems of the earth. So ravages can continue happening, and spiritual people feel that they are not part of it and they have nothing to do with it. So it is a really serious problem. The good news is that today there is a shift happening in the way we think about spirituality and about our faith. And what is fascinating is that that shift is happening on a global level, and we are seeing it in almost every religion and in every culture and in every country. We are seeing it on the ground. We're seeing an exponentially developing number of people who are involved in nonprofits, and especially young people, working for peace and justice and humanitarian relief and systemic change. But more importantly, we are seeing it in the shift of how we understand theology itself and spirituality itself, especially around three issues: the issues of love, what is love, the issues of authenticity, and the issue of the heart. These three are shifting our mind around spirituality and its role in the world, and are leading us to a spiritual evolutionary leap in these times of great challenge.
Good. I'd like to hear your thoughts about what defines constructive passion for a cause and what might be thought of as destructive or delusional passion. And I ask this because a recent article by a Russian activist and journalist and filmmaker, Andrea Vitlicek, who, like Chris Hedges, has seen more violence and places life in more danger around the world where genocides were taking place than 99% of other journalists. And I'll just quote several sentences from him because I believe it captures a certain passion for humanity that is utterly lacking in people reporting on the crimes occurring against humanity. Quote, when I am in a war, when defending revolutions, when fighting imperialism, one has to be and write as a poet. Each report has to be a part of a great novel. Otherwise, it is all irrelevant and will touch nobody and change nothing. We are human and alive, and we have a heart that is on the left and blood that is red, and all that we do as revolutionaries is because we love this world passionately. We love this humanity. We fight and are ready to die for it. Every report should have at least one poem hidden inside. It has to touch. It has to offer warmth and relief. It has to outrage and lead people onto the barricades, end quote. Now, I don't believe we have to be a mystic or follow any spiritual path to have the capacity to feel and experience this passion in our core. As long as we get the delusions of our ego and our sense of separateness out of the way. So I'd like to hear your views about this kind of sacred passion that impels us to act. And then second, I recall a late Sufi teacher saying that while rage is destructive, since it is tied up with hatred, outrage is really the universal welling up inside of us and crying out against the violations that are inflicted upon others in the earth. And I'm sure Andrew Harvey and Chris Hedges experienced this. So please speak also on the role of outrage as opposed to hatred or rage in spurring us on the path of sacred activism.
Right. Let me start answering your second question around outrage, and then I'll get to passion. This is part of that shift that is happening in our theological thinking. For a long time, we have thought of grief, for example, as being a negative feeling. So people who were on the spiritual path did everything they They could, not to feel their grief and their sadness. But if we do not feel grief and sadness, how can we empathize with the struggles of those who are oppressed, with those who are denied their right, and with the earth itself that is being devastated? So the new understanding of our spirituality says, no, grief is sacred. Grief is sacred. That grief is as important a feeling as joy. Now, the same with anger and outrage. Anger and outrage were considered, again, like a negative feeling. So spiritual people stayed away from these. But you look, for example, at the prophets in the Old Testament and at the life of Jesus himself, how and Mary, how they stood in outrage against injustice. So today we are understanding that there is a sacred outrage. When outrage is guided by love and is based on a non-violent approach to life and to the struggle, that outrage itself becomes part of our sacred spiritual path, and that we are called to be outraged about injustice. Now that leads us to the idea of passion. Passion is essential. The heart is essential. We cannot revision a society that is more based on justice and more based on participation and solidarity if we continue deriding the heart and putting the heart aside. The heart is central. It's central in our human relations. I've experienced it when I was in the peace movement in Lebanon. It is the heart that allowed bridges to be built between people of different religions to allow forgiveness, reconciliation, and reconstruction. So passion today is like a citizen's duty. We have to be passionate, passionate about our earth, passionate about the dream of God for justice and solidarity and peace and freedom. However, here is the difference between what I call passion of the heart and compulsion. Passion has to come with an understanding of inclusive pluralism, meaning that there is no one answer and there is no one solution and no one has the answer. That we get passionate about a cause and we do the very best we can about that cause. But we are not the final answer. We realize that only together, all together, in our diversity, in the diversity of our approaches and our contribution, can we come to an answer. When people get passionate and they feel that they are right and they are absolutely right, then that can lead to violence. But when people are passionate from their heart, prompted by love, by that unbounded love that we are talking about now, love for all, love for the earth, love for all of humanity, and they accept the fact that they are bringing a part of the truth and not the truth, that they do not have the final answer or the final solution, and that we have to include, that's the inclusive pluralism, include all others, even though we differ sometimes in our approaches, then passion becomes constructive, and passion becomes the heart's response to the crisis of the world, and then opens up our creativity and our energies to get involved where we are at a humanitarian level, political level, economic level. Like Stephen Hussel that just died, he was a wonderful French diplomat who actually co-wrote the Bill of Human Rights with Eleanor Roosevelt. He died at the age of 93, and at the age of 90, he wrote this book called Get Engaged, saying every citizen of the world today, it is the duty of every citizen, young, old, woman, men, all of us to get engaged and get engaged passionately. But do it out of love and with no attachment to the old thinking that there is one right answer and everybody else is wrong.
I certainly concur with that. Thank you for that insight. During all of your years of life coaching and study of mystical traditions and the great activist prophets of the past, such as Gandhi, Martin Luther King, what are your recommendations for helping people transition away from spiritual beliefs that are solely focused upon the individual, that are couched in an ethos of self-centeredness, right, narcissism, I called it the spiritual narcissist.
Yes.
Those that you
yes.
see frequently on PBS and those who had best-selling books from the 1970s and 80s and 90s and 2000s. It was all so selfish and self-centered. It wasn't true spiritualism.
Right.
And individualism removed from the rest of the world to a realization of our interconnectedness and responsibility
yes.
for the well-being and preservation of others.
Yes. Well, a couple of things, and these are all part of this development of this new global wave of spirituality. One is for people to really reflect on the concept of love and to realize that love is unbounded and to really meditate on the fullness of the idea of love, that we cannot cut love in pieces and make it like, I love my neighbors, I love my family, but I don't care about those who are mistreated, or I don't care about our gay brothers and sisters, or I don't care about the children who today are dying in greater and greater number all over the world. That love is unbounded and love is one. I think a meditation on the understanding of love, and that's why today in the second wave spirituality, there's a lot of speaking about how love is inextricably bound to the pursuit of justice, to solidarity, to freedom, democratic freedom, and to a vision of participation and transformation, that love, to allow themselves to be fully overwhelmed by the passionate love of the divine to all of creation, and to realize that if they personalize love and fall into that spiritual narcissism that you're speaking about, they are depriving themselves from the greatest force in history. And that is the force of that unbounded love. That's the first thing. The second thing that I believe is very, very important, it is for people to realize that their personal authentic journey and the journey of the world are bound. You know, spiritual people say a lot that we are all one, but they don't develop that enough to realize if we are all one, then we are all in solidarity with each other, and the well-being of one depends on the well-being of others. That when children suffer, I personally suffer in my body, that there is no disconnect. When somebody is treated unjustly, I cannot reach the fullness of my own human potential. So to understand the relationship between the pursuit of personal authenticity, which is a great Western concept, and it's a very powerful and important idea to become who you are, but to understand that I cannot become who I am unless I am involved in helping the world become free and become who it is. That I cannot separate the individual from the collective and the collective from the individual. That's a sacred paradox that cannot be broken. The more I give love, the more I get involved, the more I speak for justice, the more I can discover who I am. I don't discover who I am by retreating into workshops and meditating in the mountains away from the world. I discover who I am, like Thich Nhat Hanh, who is an engaged spiritual Buddhist, says, in meditating in action, meditating while speaking against wars, meditating while being with others, because I am inseparable from others. My health, my mental health, my well-being, my spiritual well-being, and my own discovery of my authenticity are connected to the least among us.
It
and
also
I think
takes courage.
And we have personalized the idea of feelings. You know, I have worked as a psychotherapist and definitely as a psychological and spiritual coach and done a lot of spiritual retreats, engaged social activist retreats. But it is amazing how much our culture has personalized everything. You know, we personalize our relationship, we personalize our spirituality, then we personalize our feeling. So when we ask each other, what do you feel, it's usually about some, I feel bad today because my car broke down. So we limit our feelings to our personal life, and then these feelings start overwhelming us and kidnapping our greatness. But if we realize that feelings are not personalized, let's feel what's happening in the world. Let us cry. Let us cry with the 200 young women in Nigeria that have been kidnapped. Let us feel the suffering of the earth itself. Let us feel the deep feelings of collective empathy. Then these feelings would lead us to a spiritual activism and to action like you're speaking about. But we have to break out of that personalization of our life, like my life starts with me and ends with me. It doesn't. I am a child of the earth, an offspring of the earth, and I am one with all of creation. I am part of a global system, and I cannot be taken out of that system. So to start learning to feel, this is how Gandhi felt. This is how Martin Luther King felt, how Aung San Suu Kyi of Burma feels now when she feels for her people. And the good news is, the great news is, that when we allow ourselves to have these global feelings, these larger feelings, then we become bigger. Our hearts become bigger. And we can love more our children. We can love more our mates. We become more passionate all over. But it starts by having the universal personality that, for example, Mother Teresa embraced. For every one of us to move into the universal feeling of a universal being and not a small, limited, personalized, cookie-cutter version of ourselves.
I think that's a great place to end. After all, we are 100% absorbed in our own egos, our own insecurities, our own fears, our own betrayals. And we just begin each day and finish each day, if you're the average person, disconnected from all the real problems and the real sacrifices around the world. And that's where we should put our feelings. You want to feel something today? Feel outrage at the injustice and then do something about it. Reconnect. Thank you very much, Chris, for coming on. I really appreciate it. I look forward to having another conversation with you.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you for your great work. Take care.
Thank you. Chris Saade, S-A-A-D-E, from San Diego. He is the author of Second Wave Spirituality. His website is theolivebranchcenter.net. I'm Gary Knoll. I want to thank you for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Let's say hello to Utrice Lead, standing by. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we're talking about President Obama's speech in Poland yesterday that seemed to suggest he's ratcheting up the war machine once again.
Well, there's something that we almost never discuss. We only hear people talk about how we should commit ourselves to war, what our aim of destruction against the enemy should be, never what it is in the enemy that deserves destroying. We never discuss the likely outcome that 90% of all casualties in all wars are civilians and who had nothing to do with the injustices that we're seeking redress to. Isn't it amazing? You're dealing with it, but no one else is. That's unfortunate. They haven't got that message. Then again, they're not listening to you. Maybe they will. Well, a lot of people are listening to Utrice Lead. And we're happy to see her number is growing and growing and growing. Let's go to Utrice Lead right now.